today in Rebels. Undoing second wave feminism, the dialectics of sex, family abolition, children's liberation, and much more. With Sophie Lewis.
Okay, so today we're talking to Sophie Lewis. Sophie is a researcher, writer, translator, activist, and teacher. She's the author of the book Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family, and of numerous articles that have appeared in the New York Times, The New Inquiry, Savage, Viewpoint, Jacobin, and many other left-wing journals. She's also a member of Out of the Woods, a collective that writes about ecological crisis and small C communism. You can find Sophie on Twitter, Reprotopia, and support her work on patreon.com/reprotopia. And we will link all this below in the video. So don't worry, you will not miss it. Hello, Sophie. Welcome. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi. Hi, both of you. It's really nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you're going to give us first a small intro on Shulamith Firestone and her dialectics, right?
Yeah, so I'm not going to use a script or notes. And hopefully you asked for about 10 minutes. So, you know, we'll see how coherent I manage to be about this super important sort of root text for my politics. I seem to have, those of you who, you know, watching might be vaguely aware that I also have a very complicated relationship to Donna Haraway, who I sort of love the early work and then had a very kind of impassioned kind of hostile response to some more recent kind of natalist directions in her philosophy. You know, might begin to kind of wonder if I have some sort of, you know, matricidal impulse, which I have actually taken really seriously, because I am against the tendency towards matricide in feminist philosophy, right? Of course, there's a possibility that I'm not completely self-aware here, but I believe and what I strive towards is a much more kind of complex, comradely, angry at times, but kind of, conflictually, sort of disloyally loving approach to four mothers, but, you know, given that the category of motherhood is so vexed, I'm going to kind of see if we can think about a different, you know, a forebear of a sort of cyborg ecological politics dear to my heart. Shulamith Firestone is, as many, many people have written, the kind of demon child of feminist history in many respects. And it's very sort of difficult to get to navigate through the weeds of, apologistic, kind of recuperative Firestone discourses and the kind of purely sort of simplistic dismissals. And on both sides, we have, complex kind of unholy alliances. Those who condemn her are, in some senses, among them you find patriarchs, but you also find revolutionary feminists and you find liberal feminists. And on the other side as well, those who like Shuli, as she was known, are, just as diverse as those who fear and loathe her. So it's a really complex task. She was, just to give a really brief overview, the child of an Orthodox Jewish family who wanted more than anything to be an artist and went to art school in Chicago, and became, you know, one of the key figures in the women's liberation movement. She was involved in, you know, founding several of the key revolutionary groups of, you know, New York radical feminism, basically. And in the Important History of Women's Liberationism by Alice Eccles, that, you know, it's important to be aware of, Daring to be Bad, Shuli, you know, comes into focus as one of the real sort of the real firebrands of this New York radical milieu in the 60s. So in 1970, this, you know, completely, you know, bananas, miraculous text comes out by this, you know, kind of prodigy, Shulamith Firestone, which kind of remixes Marx, Engels, Freud, and many other kind of canonical figures of, you know, what she would probably call, you know, mainstream philosophy, very, very breezily in its first few pages, and kind of proceeds to elaborate, as the first kind of edition called it, in, you know, in all caps with an exclamation point, you know, the case for feminist revolution, brackets, chapter 6 will change your life. It is not, you know, actually possible, I think, to overstate how utopian the vision expressed in the Dialectic of Sex really is. And I mean utopian in a very specific sense. I'm not interested in visions of utopia that envision a kind of post-political, post-agonistic kind of island where everything is kind of fine. But I'm interested in utopianism of the kind of almost childish, blinkered quality that asks why received realities, why the production of nature as we know it should be accepted, and insists in a sort of pig-headed, stubborn way on a really, truly livable life, and on keeping every possibility on the table. And so for Shulamith, and she says this in the first few pages, you know, complete communist revolution is absolutely obviously necessary, but it's not even enough, right? if there is a word more totalizing than revolution, more all-encompassing than revolution, we would use it. I can't quite find the exact phrase, but she's very clear about this. For her, you know, the communization of all aspects of reality is something she doesn't even really need to defend or argue. That's already kind of a given. And for her, she's impatient with people's conservatism in wanting only that. So it kind of really, you know, it's a hell of a sort of whiplash sensation, I think, diving into this book. And, you know, I this is me being sympathetic to it, but I should say, you know, I disagree with many of the premises on which she bases, you know, her dialectic, which she says is, you know, based on sexuate sort of biological difference. The before we get to, you know, true liberation, I misphrased this. I don't know if you can. I'm saying for her, sex difference is more important than that which Marx and Engels are concerned with, and therefore, you know, communist revolution may occur without real revolution, i.e., you know, sexual liberation taking place. So she may, you know, I disagree with this, and of course, recent, you know, communist advances in theory around the sex gender distinction, which in some ways, you know, you can't really fault Firestone for not having developed yet, I suppose. But, you know, of course, we, you know, for me, there is very little that appeals to me here in this kind of constant insistence she has that, you know, sex is more radical of an oppression, more all-encompassing. You know, but having said that, you know, if you can get past the, you know, the really sort of brutally dated elements of her argumentation and the hallmarks of her, you know, very depressing fights with, you know, the, you know, what she calls the male chauvinist labor movement, the male chauvinist black radical movement as well. If you can get past the sort of the completely unacceptable reactivities and you know, prejudices she has actually towards femmes, towards anti-racists, you know, which are not really, I'm not proposing to forgive them, but if we can suspend attention to them, we have, I think, an arguably extremely queer text, a text that undoes itself and which reaches a place quite different to its beginning in its final pages. Because although, you know, I've just been this morning revisiting the opening salvos and then contrasting them to the final chapter, you know, which is called The Ultimate Revolution. And she really kind of lays down what she calls her demands and speculations around feminism and ecology, around what abolishing the family would really mean, and so on and so forth. And by this point, although she spent so much time, you know, just 200 pages before, talking about, you know, how, you know, left predilections and preoccupations should be, you know, taken with a grain of salt, and we should really all kind of wake up to the primacy of sex. She's the final sentences, you know, are simply concerned with a cybernetic communism that would abolish economic classes and all forms of labor exploitation, granting all people a livelihood based only on material needs. Eventually, work would be eliminated in favor of play, activity done for its own sake by adults as well as children. And with the disappearance of motherhood and the obstructing incest taboo, sexuality would be reintegrated, allowing love to flow unimpeded. You know, and the word women doesn't even occur in that in this final passage, right? It's been kind of dialectically you know, transcended, I suppose. So you know, you have to put on a kind of trans feminist lens to engage with the dialectic of sex, but I think there is a great deal to be gained from doing that. In a recent, you know, very personal lecture I gave about my, you know, my relationship to Firestone and the way that she reminds me of my impossible, you know, like Firestone, and like Firestone, very kind of depressed, unhappy, abusive, arguably, and kind of wronged and sort of tragic alcoholic mother who died last year. You know, I wanted to insist as well that in the criticism of Firestone, I rarely see it said how horny she is. And recently we've had a kind of return, I think, in some parts of the queer left, to looking at figures like Mario Mieli towards a gay communism, and of course Chris Chitty's extraordinary sexual hegemony. And you know, it just really occurred to me that Firestone, and this makes sense because she is kind of on the face of it just astonishingly hetero sexist, like sort of limited to heterosexuality, And it, you know, I don't, again, I'm not asking for a sort of excuse for this. It's dumb. It's absurd. It's a real failing in the text. But she is, she loves to fuck. And the main thing she, you know, hopes for in many ways, for the post-revolutionary society, it has to do with the conditions of possibility for pleasurable fucking. And that constitutes a sort of affinity, I think, with figures like Miele. And although there is a different approach to the utopian in Chitty, also Chitty, you know, because I think we could gain something from weaving together Firestone's materialist view on history as a process of kind of imprisonment of women and children within homes, and the history of kind of the policing and disciplining of deviant sexual populations, and the repression of a sort of imminent transsexualism, you know, for Miele. So, you know, this would be a case, I guess, for Firestone against Firestone, a kind of queer trans feminist hedonistic Firestone that kind of bursts imminently from between the cracks of her deeply and frustratingly limited you know, utopian manifesto. I don't know. I'll pause now.
Yeah, no, that's that was beautiful. And actually you already touched on both things that I really wanted to talk to you about. My first question was about, that I wanted to ask, was about how we read texts like Firestone's. And maybe you have already answered this question to the extent that it's even possible to answer this question. But I mean, you in all of your writing, you draw on like a very eclectic array of sources. And I mean, at the moment, I'm also working with texts from the sort of 60s and 70s. And I mean, when we read them today, they're just like full of all of these political faux pas. And the radical feminists in particular are often remembered for a lot of like racism and biological essentialism and queer phobia. And I think some of it strikes us as like quite embarrassing and naive at best. And this is why you mentioned reading Schulman and Firestone is a complex task. And I mean, most of what you just sort of spoke about were disavowals of a lot of what she wrote, but at the same time, holding on to the utopian and revolutionary element. I don't know that this is possible to answer, but I guess my question is, when you work with texts like Firestone, it's not just Firestone, how do we read them in a way that's sort of ethical and also like politically, you know what I'm getting at? Like, is it about recuperation, or is it about reading a text through a, as you said, like a queer trans feminist lens from today? Or is it about suspending certain issues in order to cover something?
Yeah. Well, I think reading Firestone with your emotional responses kind of switched on has been useful for me, you know, so rather than actually adopting that kind of haughty almost kind of numbed approach to texts from the 60s, where we know so much better now, and therefore we're kind of academically removed. I think actually, paradoxically, I've found it much more generative to, but maybe this is a personal thing, because as I say, I have I have associations between Shirley and her kind of witty, like mean and tragic life trajectory. You know, the beautiful quote that is often kind of fronted in reflections on her. There was a massive N+1 double feature where people kind of poured out their love for this figure, but in itself, this kind of, you know, memorialization and celebration was tragic in a meta sense, because so many of the people who were appreciating her hadn't seen her for decades, and, you know, loved her even though they couldn't really stand her. And, you know, she disappeared after writing this book almost entirely from the political scene, and then died alone in an apartment in New York, despite efforts on the part of certain kinds of committees of comrades to help her, to intervene in her spiral into suicidality and isolation. But, you know, I think understanding the person is perhaps not something I would seek to, you know, avoid. I think it's a personal text, and there are lots of people who engage with it more impersonally, but I think this text tells us something about our own seductions into reaction. You know, she has somatophobic, kind of femphobic, heteronormative sorts of failings as a person, and perhaps some of the kind of unkindness and callousness and lack of empathy towards people she calls, you know, politicos, you know, women in the Black Panthers. She is really angry at them for being so kind of, she quotes certain instances of pamphlets where she thinks the women of the Black Panthers are being just disgustingly kind of indulgent towards male ego, you know, but all these kinds of animuses she has, all these kinds of grumpy, nasty, unempathetic forms of radicalism, you know, you can relate them quite easily to personalities in the political ecology of today, you know, like dirtbag discourses, sorts of phobic, anti-woke posturing. And so I think if you, for me, clearly I've tried to be a bit confessional about how, you know, loving while raging against Shuli is a similar process to me as the process of grieving my mother, but thus also kind of, you know, repairing myself and inquiring into the forms of kind of repetition and continuity of these failures in myself. So it can be, you know, I guess that's an argument for a kind of almost therapeutic encounter with this text, you know, because it is so vitally personal. I should say, right, like not everyone maybe knows this. It's written as a kind of comic monologue in many cases. You know, it's a utopian manifesto that is not pretending, you know, organizational objectivity. This is pure Shirley, you know, the phrases, the made up words. She has a real kind of, sort of stand-up character in her prose. It's like listening to an extremely talented stand-up comedian, you know, who is, you know, weaving in her own flavors all the time. To answer your question, I think it's, I think it also helps, you know, to remember that there were all kinds of different feminism in the 60s. There wasn't, you know, the racist kind of naive, endlessly kind of, dismissed as such second wave feminism doesn't really exist, you know? Emma Heaney mentions, dedicates a whole book to this, really, in sort of turning the received version of, you know, cis feminist history on its head, and, you know, explaining how, via a combination of sort of sexological science and trans feminine allegory in literature throughout modernism, that, you know, feminism became cis, was made cis, you know. And this is a more sophisticated project, building on, you know, Alice Eccles' super important insistence in her history that what has been written as the history of the second wave is actually the version written down by a super reactionary and at the time recognized as such as reactionary fringe element of that ecology of utopian and less utopian elements who were queerphobic, transphobic, and sort of woundedly attached to a universalist definition of sexed suffering and femaleness as suffering. And they, you know, they get to explain what radical feminism was, and they are still doing it in England, you know, weirdly enough, in the sort of mainstream institutions of establishment British culture. And so, you know, we that is the second wave. That's the hegemonic definition. But of course, in, you know, in the 60s, there were lots of people saying, you know, much more nuanced things than Firestone about the relationship between race and sex and, you know, the dynamics of kind of queer revolution, as we know, because we have new translations of Nelly and so on. However, as you know, and I'm sure this is kind of why you've invited me, you know, I'm someone who believes that there is an important case to be made for reviving family abolitionist discourse in the 21st century. And my book could not have, you know, existed without Firestone lighting the spark, right? I forgot to finish that quote because I ramble, but the really tear-jerking phrase that gets kind of quoted in memorializations of Firestone is that she lit the spark and took the heat, as her name implies, Firestone. The spark she lit in my, I can't believe I'm tearing up over Shuli. It's just really intense the way I respond to her as a figure. But the way she addresses pregnancy and what I then in full surrogacy now call the problem of pregnancy is, I think, you know, an inexorably important contribution to radical thought. You know, I don't share her somatophobic reasons for questioning pregnancy. You know, my take on pregnancy is that everybody should be allowed to do whatever kind of life endangering, kind of kinky, extreme sport that they like, as long as there is a situation, an infrastructure, a society that doesn't compel you to do that against your will. And perhaps, you know, we could think about why 300,000 people die doing this particular kind of labor, and we still think it's just normal and natural and even to be expected of people that they engage in it, right? So discipline me more into
awesome. No, it's awesome and it's going in. I mean, actually, the histories in like Alice Eccles' work and Emma Heaney's work is such an important thing for precisely this reason, that we can sort of better understand the conditions under which this intellectual work was being produced and then hopefully engage with it more productively. But I think we should definitely, Felix, we should definitely link the N+1 thing in the description, because it's just such a wonderful collection of letters or whatever we might call them. And it's everybody that engages with the Shulamith Firestone seems to remember her so much for her just sort of her nature and her revolutionary spirit and her utopianism. And I actually, I wanted to ask you, like, because you're also quite an incandescent writer, like, I mean, the genres kind of disappear. We don't find this very much. And there's like resonances between that spirit in both of your work. I'm sure you're aware of that. But I mean, maybe this isn't something you want to comment on, and we've already moved into the territory of family abolition. So if you want to come back to that, feel free to. One thing I'm really curious about is in this project of family abolition, which also kind of like Firestone herself disappeared very quickly. That was being written at a time when the nuclear family was something very different to what it is today. And Christopher Chitty writes about this very well. So in this sort of like sexually hegemonic era is what he would call it, we have basically the reconsolidation of the Fordist nuclear family in the post-war era, which is sort of central to a lot of structural adjustments that are happening. So the rationalization of the production process and can you say something about the context in which these thinkers were writing and what the family meant when they were talking about family abolition in the late 60s and 70s?
Yeah, I think you're right to bring up the fact that it had some differences. I think I would insist that there are still continuities in the form of the family that we're facing today and the form that Firestone was inveighing against in, you know, 1968, 1970. Yeah, I mean, this kind of, as you say, it's defined by the post-war. I mean, she talks about this in her second chapter about American feminism, which is just, by the way, parenthetically, super weird as well. I should have maybe mentioned that she has a level of, enthusiasm for sort of figures like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony that I find completely mystifying, right? But she kind of gives this, she does a historical summary of why, the conditions that Betty Friedan described poorly and not very materialistically in the feminine mystique came about. You know, she says that women could not be simply asked to quit their jobs that they had been allowed to take during the war, and so they had to be kind of culturally and ideologically reprogrammed into a form of labor linked to domesticity and invisibilized as work within the home. And, you know, for Firestone, the family in this kind of 50s mode is inextricable from the rise of, the generalization throughout society of Freudianism, the misguided feminism, she says. And, you know, part of her analysis, it is not what I kind of center, right, or even pay completely, you know, I don't necessarily pay attention to this, but for her, the prison that is this nuclear family situation is propped up by psychoanalysis, which could have liberatory possibilities, but doesn't. And in fact, channels us into the opposite of politics and the opposite of political struggle, and channels us onto the psychiatrist's couch, the analyst's couch, rather than raising out consciousness as collective agents of history. I mean, okay, of course, having said this, I mean, there are compelling and also very funny kind of elements of this critique, but it is the case that, Firestone commits the sort of cardinal errors of, forgetting, or she lapses. There are times where she gets it and more times, unfortunately, where she lapses into, you know, blindness or, you know, unawareness of the Black feminist radical critique of the whole kind of Betty Friedan moment in feminism, where, you know, figures like Angela Davis were saying, you know, well, which which women are you talking about as excluded from the labor force? You know, wages for whose housework? We already have wages, right? Not that, sorry, I'm eliding Friedan and Federici, which is obviously kind of bonkers, but you know, there were problems with elements of the articulation of housewife misery that could be leveled at both the sort of the feminine mystique and then the wages for housework moment, which is sort of concurrent with Firestone, right? Wages against housework and the dialectic of sex are sort of different ways of articulating the need to abolish the family in the same exact moment, really. Although it's strange because I don't really think they are often thought of as exact kind of contemporaries, if you know what I mean. I make a kind of case in my book for them both being family abolitionist texts, you know, and, you know, wages for housework quickly became in many ways liberatory on race as well. Black women for wages for housework was an important plinth in that global movement. And it is often misunderstood. This is not what we have gathered here to talk about, but, you know, I do have a bit of a bee in my bonnet about the misunderstanding of wages for housework as a kind of sort of anti-utopian demand for literal wages, when it is in fact about the sort of exploding of the reproduction-production distinction on which the entire kind of edifice of work society rests. And it's about refusing work having become visible as workers who wish to abolish themselves as workers, right? Brackets, that's the point of communism, not some kind of redistributive justice. Okay, but yeah. Trying to keep kind of limit to the point here. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Firestone came from an extremely traditional and orthodox patriarchal household. She distinguishes between the biological family, which she says is sort of trans-historic, and the nuclear family, which is only a few decades old, about a century old at the time when she is writing. It's important to understand now that in the 21st century, we have a sort of mutated configuration of that property logic. It's above all a property logic, you know, dividing people into isolated private properties legitimated by ideologies of sort of biogenetic and marriage or marriage adjacent certification in the eyes of the law is still a very important component of the ordering of both neoliberalism and neoconservative power. This is kind of the analysis that Melinda Cooper gives in her book Family Values, where basically in response to the age-old complaint that the family is kind of dead, you know, basically, this is a phrase of Sarah Bruyette's when she reviewed Cooper, you know, the family is not nearly dead enough, right? It is always undead. In fact, people have been complaining about the demise of the nuclear family since way before Firestone was even kind of inveighing against it. There's the part of the logic of the family for Cooper is its perpetual crisis and it the need for it to be defended. And that's paradoxically why it kind of can be put at the center of an austerity logic that sort of blackmails us into little chauvinistic kind of teams, ensuring our survival at the expense of a sort of potential for different class insurrections. I don't know. If I were working off notes, this would doubtless be a little bit more comprehensive and, you know, articulate, but I hope there was something. Do you agree?
Yeah,
how
yeah.
do you understand it?
I actually think that, what you were, we were, I think usually there is a different, like there's a confrontation when you bring up ideas about abolishing the family, because there's always existing different ideas of what the family means. And there's always like this, like it's really much attached to very deep feelings of identity that people feel that configure people's individuality. And I think what you were discussing now is at least it's useful to like make it clear that we were talking about the family unit as a institution that emerged out of a set of property relations, out of like a economic unit and a sort of necessities that are like functional for the proper development of capitalism, right? And in that sense, this is like the kind of institution that is reproducing itself and reinventing itself in different shapes and is historically constituted, right? And that's how we talk about discontinuities and continuities. And I was interested to know if you could actually say a bit more about how you see the family functioning today in that particular way, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is the, and
yeah.
what is your case of family abolition basically today, let's say?
Yeah.
Can I just add something real quick? Because
yeah.
one thing I'm curious about, because both Christopher Chidi and Melinda Cooper have now come up, and I sort of both encountered these texts at about the same time. And what struck me is that Chidi, the way he charts it is like, you know, since the 80s, we've just seen the disinhibition of sexual mores, divorce rates increasing, you know, single parenting increasing, the couple forum being somehow like delegitimized, parenting customs changing. And the picture you sort of get there is like the family is unraveling, which is very different from Melinda Cooper's account, which sort of highlights how, no, in fact, the nuclear family is still very central to neoliberal capitalism. And I wonder what Chidi's politics of family abolition would be. And yeah, this is just to, I mean, this is Felix, what Felix was already saying, but I wonder like where you stand in that debate, or is it like helpful of thinking it as like a,
yeah,
just like demise or reconsolidation or, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, no, this is, that's a super good question. Yeah, well, okay. It's something I would like to give a really comprehensive answer to, and it does present certain contradictions, and I'm intrigued by this framing, which I think is correct. But you know, I guess part of what this kind of story of the family and perpetual crisis and under threat tells us is that to some extent, family values ideology can survive quite an extensive sort of on the ground kind of unraveling of its actual, you know, lived reality. I think it's also important to understand that, you know, the family was always somewhat of a fiction. Aspects of its description of social life were always, you know, open kind of lies. Everyone understands that monogamy exists as a, you know, a disciplinary morality for women, not for men, and that, you know, monogamy within marriage exists only, you know, to the extent that, you know, children need to be certified as, you know, biological heirs of men, and, you know, so on and so forth, right? The whole history of prostitution as the, you know, the supplement, the official, the state sanctioned supplement to the nuclear family kind of demonstrates the way that it's not actually about genuinely kind of dictating the ways that people live, but it's about providing infrastructures that can police and punish deviations from the property laws that undergird the story, right? So I guess those basic premises haven't really shifted so much, even though there are increasingly kind of single person households, you know, parenting is changing on the face of it. You know, people go back and live with their parents because they can't afford houses of their own. You know, there are sort of changes and modifications, but I guess sort of A, the aspirations for neoliberal subjects remain very much tethered to coupling and procreativity. You know, you freeze your eggs to enable you to have a career, fine, but you know, the essential kind of investment in a sort of future biogenetic portfolio sort of remains in place. We also B, the logic of verifiable sort of biogenetic belonging is still really materially important at the border and at the border within nation state territory. So not only if you are a kind of migrant family, are you subjected, at least in theory, there was a proposal for this, you know, to a DNA test to ensure whether you're actually really crossing the border into the land of family values and democracy as a family, as a certifiable family, because, you know, the myth would be that if you are certifiably, you know, biological relatives, then a sort of set of, you know, affordances and rights and sort of social wages might be, you know, made available to you. Of course, that's not the case, because as Hortense Spillers and, you know, theorists in that vein have kind of suggested, the, you know, the migrant, the Black family is kind of a bit of a contradiction in terms. You don't, it doesn't matter how your, you know, flesh was generated really, or it does, but only epiphenomenally. The family that we are talking about as a disciplinary structure has a relationship to whiteness and to bourgeois property ownership, right? But still, there are stories that are used to exclude, right? So people at the border can be subjected to family authenticity tests in order to police and discipline and incarcerate them. And then in hospitals, you know, sometimes homicidally homophobic parents can be given access to, you know, the bodies of people because of their kind of family link, whereas you know, the partners and comrades of queer people, as we know, obviously including from the history of AIDS, you know, are not given the sort of social rights that should be there for next of kin, you know. So we have, you know, we have insurrections against bourgeois kinship, I guess is a way you could say it. We have movements of sort of counter kinning, the sort of indigenous and Black kinds of alternative articulations of kinship that is explicitly made, right? Not imagined as given, which is much more kind of multiple, plural, and oriented towards not leaving people out in the cold. What do you think?
I think it's really interesting that you've brought up like these things around biological reproduction and how that actually inflates or like divides or informs feminist struggles, let's say, like my own. So I have this is something that is like part of my own interest and like my private research or like current obsession, if we want to call it like that, which is the way in which, okay, the family is this institution that we are understanding as performing like cultural reproduction. So it reproduces the values of the society, and it also performs biological reproduction, right? So like there is perceived in these two particular aspects. And it is precisely when it comes to the role, or like it's in both, but I feel that it becomes more like at the moment when we were talking about biological reproduction, it's when it has become, it can get turned against particular queer struggles. And I was interested in what you were saying now of like the different forms of feminism that articulate against particular privileges or advantages that you get by having this kind of belonging through like biological kinship. And I was curious about when you've been, because you have worked around these particular issues when it comes to actually gestation and what it implies. So like if you have come up with some moments in which precisely the fact that there's such a thing as biological reproduction has make a like a point of departure between or create tensions between feminism and a queer movement, which has, in my opinion, always been very much like connected historically in the same concerns, like the emancipation of gender and sexual, like sexuality, let's say. So I don't know.
So Firestone is really important, I think, as this is helpful. As a kind of paradoxical, because she herself doesn't understand this and doesn't think about queers, but she's a paradoxical kind of point of mediation, maybe, between women's liberation and kind of queer liberation, because she insists on children's liberation, and that's I think the vanishing like mediator potentially. You know, we think about the history of gay liberation in tandem with children's liberation, but actually the component of children's liberation in feminist history is often forgotten, and that's a really interesting problem or question. Why is that? For Firestone, she is incandescently opposed to the proprietarian aspects of the mother-child relation. And she has this fantastic series of, you know, kind of riffs about how she gets it. She gets what the affordances are of having a baby of your own to fuck up as you please, you know? And of course, you know, the struggle for kind of gay and queer kind of equalities and liberties has included the desire to have that same complicated, ambivalent option. You know, as a feminist, we don't, you know, I don't know, I don't think many people sort of demand of other feminists that they immediately kind of stop having children and enjoying kind of that complicated, messy, partially proprietarian kind of relation. But we sort of do seem to demand that of queer people. But for Firestone, it's extremely important that nobody think of babies as their own. And so that kind of helps us when we think about the gestational labor that, you know, queer couples or, you know, gay couples or households kind of want to enroll, enlist, surrogate for them. You know, Firestone actually provides us with a very kind of clear, uncompromising, you know, position, platform that tells us, no, the baby doesn't belong to anybody in the first place. And, you know, a child's dependence on adults should always, in all circumstances, be conceived of as something plural, collective, mutual, and limited in scope, right? She says that children's dependence on adults should be the basis for the formation of a unit that then disbands upon the child's like majority. She thinks it's really important that households should disband once they have kind of committed together to the nurture of a vulnerable because very young kind of person. And that's a question of emancipation for all people concerned, you know. So you have this kind of ethics and politics of multi-gendered polymaternalism, I would argue. She it's not how she would necessarily see it, but for me this implies, you know, a very kind of sort of I almost want to say a sort of universalist in a good sense. There's, you know, we are all kind of faced with the contingency of our embodiment. I mean, many people with uteruses don't or can't or whatever gestate. She doesn't understand how much her theory of binary, you know, her theory's dependence on binary sex sort of leaves out all kinds of people and all kinds of realities. But it doesn't really matter, because I think if you squint, you can read it as a very kind of gender abolitionist kind of text. The imperative to produce each other transgenerationally, including and intergenerationally, is kind of there, right? The opposition between a kind of queer struggle for access to reproductive technology and a feminist struggle for that same access disappears, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think, for instance, in Spain, there was like this debate a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, I think, by the time of the elections, it was included in the program of the Biden. They framed themselves as like the central neo, like liberal party, but basically they were like right neoliberals. Like, and their own point was that they wanted to bring the demands of the LGBTQ community by making legal surrogacy as it stands within a capitalist society. Let's say creating the enterprises where women can enter like surrogacy and stuff like that. And there was like, it was a heated debate actually, because it was in a way also dividing deeply what they conceive as the demands of the mainstream LGBTQ movement, which I don't know like who was actually the representative of that in particular, and like the particular lines of feminists that were actually arguing against that. And I like the way you actually come up with this idea of, well, you know, you just were discussing about that, that once you actually detach the idea, the notion of property of your own kid, like fetuses or your own children, then you're already moving beyond this idea of who, like, whether your family is in itself necessarily this idea of owning people and creating a set of relations that are like framed within the family in itself. I was also thinking,
No, no, go on.
No, I was also thinking about, and Alex, you should come in also at some point as well. But I was thinking in the sense in which, by defending the family as the place of the woman, which is a position that sometimes some feminist some parts of the feminism have occupied, they are coming into a like a clash within demands of some LGBTQ, some demands of the LGBTQ movement from moving away from the family as an institution where actually sexuality is not fully expressed. Because if you want to reproduce the institution of the family as the reproductive unit of a society, you also need to set particular gender and sexual roles, right? Mm-hmm. And in that way, it becomes kind of antagonistic with a project of sexual emancipation.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of these really interesting contradictions exist within like the figure of Firestone herself, you know, the anecdotes collected in these, you know, memories on the occasion of her, you know, really awful, tragic death, alone in an apartment, you know, include these kinds of anecdotes about how when she was 20, she invited a heterosexual couple over for Thanksgiving to her house, but she just simply hadn't cooked the turkey or anything, because I mean she was definitely this kind of non-neurotypical figure who had these kinds of macho kind of predilections as well, right? She talks in her book about how awful it is when you know, men want to go out with you and talk about Simone de Beauvoir with you while leaving their, like his wife, at home with the diapers. And she understands that, but she's the one going out with the guy to talk about Beauvoir. And there's this anecdote about how she had her friends over for Thanksgiving and the woman ended up in tears because there was this kind of terrible kind of maybe structurally queer way in which she, but you know, only in a very limited sense, kind of queer, because, you know, because actually macho, you know, she was sort of, if that, I'm not doing a great job of articulating these tensions, but there is something so fascinating and therefore useful about her personal responses to the sorts of contradictions between her desire and the structures that police them in the present. So she's on the verge of femme solidarity, you know, because she likes to get fucked, I think. and she doesn't like cooking. But she has contempt for women who do. And that's the bit that really kind of falls flat and becomes a kind of anti-queer component of her theorizing, which also makes her thought about pregnancy that little bit less effective. Because the reasons she has for denouncing pregnancy, many of them are quite powerful, but then some of them are like, oh, it's gross. It's gross. It's really feminine. It's monstrously feminine, you know? And that's a part that I think really weakens her claims and exposes her to all these kinds of rightful, you know, criticisms and disputes and confusions over the years. But what if we could kind of, you know, take the brilliance of certain moments of her kind of bombshell, kind of dickhead, angry, rageful, utopian kind of collision with the structures of 1960s American sociality, and sort of supplement them and complement them with all the insights of Black and queer radicalism. I think there's something there, you know?
Yeah. Alex, do you want to say something? I wanted to come up with something else, but since I've been
I have nothing smart to say. I've just been enjoying the loving critique of Firestone very, 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 very much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
it's a lesson in some ways, isn't it? She wrote this kind of brilliant thing, but she dedicates it to Beauvoir. And in the very first pages of her book, she talks about Beauvoir as someone whose brilliance overshot its mark, right? This is such a fascinating aspect, because she herself is clearly identifying so hard. She has a problem with Beauvoir's kind of intellectual overshooting and commitment to a sort of Hegelian concept and a certain kind of existentialist framework that she thinks is leading her awry. Perhaps she has overshot her mark. She talks about Beauvoir in this very kind of personal, invested way. And then here I am, kind of thinking that the same can be said of Firestone. And as soon as she kind of gave birth to this text, she basically, died a political death. She couldn't bear to talk politics again, by some accounts. It was unbearable. And I think that's partly because of a certain kind of, machismo, I always want to say. She doesn't have that necessary kind of attention to vulnerability and contradiction. She doesn't tolerate, perhaps, the elements of kind of, traumatized, messy, investment in the structures of the present. She doesn't finally tolerate them. She understands so well, in order to joke about it, why it's nice to kind of have a baby and a house and so on. She can joke about that with enough empathy to make it very vivid and true and relatable. But then ultimately she burns up in disgust. She doesn't know what to do, because her utopia is so totalizing. I mean, by the way, I haven't even mentioned, she talks about annihilating culture. The list of things that she wants to abolish is unthinkably long. And, today we are, a lot of us, abolitionists. We talk about prison abolition and, abolishing the police and the border. But, Firestone wants to abolish culture. I haven't heard that talked about very much in the last few years, and I'm not sure I really know what it means. It's one of the most dated chapters in the Firestone. But, she's an artist. She really just wanted to paint pictures. And so having written this kind of almost unbearably ambitious text, I don't know how she read Freud, Marx, Engels, and all these terrible reactionaries. She has a real bug, a bee in her bonnet about this kind of reactionary chauvinist psychologist, Theodore Reich, I think. Am I getting that right? But she keeps quoting this this terrible psychoanalytic thinker. And she's clearly, she read so much. She kind of remixed it.
And she somehow read it at 25. I'm turning 25 in 2 weeks. Yeah. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
It's curious that you're saying this about abolishing culture, because yesterday I was reading this text from August Bebel, was social women and socialism. I think socialism, the future of society of the future, was, I don't remember exactly which one was, but he's mentioning about this idea of culture exactly when discussing about abolishing the family, in the sense of the argument was something like, culture exists based on the fact that we have servants that have created the material conditions for culture to emerge. So once you kind of give away this, you do away with culture. I don't know if that's what Firestone is, like where Firestone is coming from, in the sense that we would have some sort of expression that would be something different to what has been historically conceived as culture, because it's based on like the separation between mental labor and physical labor or something.
Yeah, as I understand it, there's something very kind of, I mean, on the face of it, deeply deterministic about her understanding of a sort of dialectic between the masculine technological principle and the feminine aesthetic principle. And that, you know, this needs to be like undone. I'm not really equipped to comment on the nuances of it and the extent to which her dialectic is sort of self-aware or already kind of, it does seem to me that when in her opening salvos about the concept of nature, which I myself, as an erstwhile human geographer who is really in the sort of in the weeds of you know, eco-Marxist and Marxist feminist ecological debates about the production of nature, nature as an accumulation strategy, in the phrase of Neil Smith, you know, I'm more comfortable with talking about nature than I am about culture. Although, of course, you know, for Haraway, the concepts need to be, you know, collapsed into nature culture. I think, you know, for me, it just reads as deeply as incorrect. The parts of Beauvoir that I also disagree with would be, you know, would be the same as Firestone's take on nature as kind of a real thing, you know, and something to be overcome, you know, and dominated. But she quotes Beauvoir as saying that humans are not animals. And like, you can kind of understand the Enlightenment sort of set of preconceptions that contained within that statement. You know, at this point, I don't even know how to find my way back to criticizing, you know, the basic sorts of divisions and dyads of, you know, man versus nature, because in human geography, we're, you know, we've kind of taken off into all kinds of different animacies and, you know, we're talking about symbiogenesis and the sort of art of non-human species. But, you know, I think it's kind of, it's part of her somatophobia, I would argue, when she says that, you know, with Beauvoir, that humans aren't animals. I mean, we obviously are. and if that is supposed to mean that we should kind of, you know, gain a sort of mastery over our bodies that entails a sort of a suppression, a repression, a disavowal, a colonization, then I would argue that the politics there is always going to end up being racist. But I am okay with talking about a sort of a Métisse sort of grassroots, plural, cyborgian approach to technology that would include a utopian commitment to having things like ectogenetic biobag supplements for human gestational labor that could be kind of shared and developed and made available, although not imposed, you know, so we could talk about, you know, she does actually say this in a kind of non-compulsory way. She talks about how babies could be born to male and female bodies, you know, both, or, you know, or potentially to machines, but the compulsory sort of and mutually defining you know, link between femaleness and maternal gestational authorship would be severed. I think it's interesting to remember that, you know, things become unthinkable very swiftly in the course of history. And in Philadelphia, down the road from where I'm living, there are actually, you know, neonatal sheep being gestated in plastic bags full of salt fluid, which is a surprisingly almost kind of incomprehensibly sort of simple technology that could very, very readily be, you know, be duplicated by grassroots gestational gynpunk utopians all over the world, actually. And they are testing it, at least they were before COVID, on human, you know, premature fetuses. That was the plan for last year. I actually haven't been able to find out what's going on there. But, you know, it does seem to me that, you know, there is too ready a kind of dismissal of the, you know, the technological components of Firestone's vision. You know, she is sort of mischaracterized as someone who, you know, who is of the kind of accelerationist sort of silver bullet kind of let the machines do it kind of variety of Marxist. And, you know, she brings that on herself to an extent with the machismo that I mentioned. But actually, you know, she completely understands that were gestational labor to be put into the hands of capitalist technology now, it would be a nightmare, as is anything that is, you know, enacted by capitalist subjects. I mean, it's never going to be emancipatory if it is, you know, advanced by the ruling class. But you know, that's not an argument. You know, the anti-surrogacy feminists are so obviously to me bioconservative and sort of woundedly attached to a transhistoric definition of sex suffering and a sort of wounded attachment to you know, gestational suffering specifically as something that must not under any conditions be sort of shared with, you know, trans women or anyone else. And I think we need to push against that politics, you know, even as we push against the kind of homonormative politics of kind of, you know, gay parenting on the property mode, right? The sort of the confusion of sort of gay nuclear parenting with queer liberation, you know. I think it would be cool if we could all kind of share the work of pregnancy a little bit, interrupt it, you know, delegate it, attenuate its burdens qua work, by really thinking you know, in a utopian fashion about how to organize it. Because if you just look at it in that pig-headed way I was talking about at the beginning, which is kind of that childlike way in which, you know, Firestone is a subject of children's liberation as much as she is of women's liberation, you know, it doesn't make sense. Pregnancy is unacceptable. and that simple, you know, blinding truth of her book is something I think, you know, really deserves preserving.
Yeah. I really like how you put this, exactly the two opposites that become to collide between the homonormative desire to have the kids on your own, to build a family that has your own genetic code as well, and then this kind of grounded attachment to pregnancy that can also like overflow into like maternalistic discords that then expand to like different areas of like the political ecology, let's say. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. And I like that it was very clear how you put it for me. And
I don't know.
I just said that I think I spotted an octopus on your bookshelf. Can that be?
Oh yeah.
I love it.
My essay about octopus Eros is coming out in N+1 really soon. Oh. And I'm a little bit nervous.
Oh no, I'm so happy that that conversation is being kept alive.
Good.
Enough of it.
That's good to hear, you know, because some people are really kind of unkind about the sort of supposed, like, I don't know what I'm being charged with. It's kind of opportunistic or venal or self-promotional to make hay out of the scandal, or, you know, which I'm also often accused of engineering on purpose, you know, as though when I was tripping on acid and making my remarks about an octopus documentary, I kind of knew what would occur and how it would somehow make me famous and get me an essay at N+1 magazine. You know, it's not the case, but I feel quite upset nevertheless sometimes with the sort of yeah, the imputation of this kind. And also, I don't want to instrumentalize that poor octopus. But yeah, I do say I'm really proud of the work I've done thinking about erotophobia in the current COVID conjuncture, and speculating as hard, you know, as thoughtfully as I can about the reasons we freaked out en masse about me noticing that a cephalopod was sexy, particularly right now. So I think that would be another cool thing to have a conversation about at some future point, maybe.
Definitely.
Is there anything else that we should touch on?
Yeah, I think, what do you think about wrapping up by now? And maybe we can just comment a bit. This is not a small question, but we can address it, or I don't know, like, see how we feel. But I am, one of my questions as well is, like, in which sense family abolition is a revolutionary ideal for both feminism and queer politics, which I think we have touched upon many of these things already. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you see this? Why is that in this?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's indisputably, you know, it's known as one of the sort of demands of gay liberation. To a lesser extent, I think we're aware that it's part of utopian socialism, Charles Fourier, and then, you know, Bolshevik figures, Alexandra Kollontai. But I think Firestone is seen as standing alone in the sort of feminist sort of department of the history of revolutionary struggle in talking about it. And that is deeply unfortunate. And as I say, I don't want to let her off the hook, because it's kind of a crying shame that this happens to be the case about her discourse, because it is fair to say that it is a chauvinist discourse in some senses. And there are moments of real kind of femphobic kind of contempt and paradox. You know, it's paradoxical, because she's kind of so, you know, she's so anti women who put communism before feminism. Like, she goes on and on and on about it all the time. You know, she thinks it's a real problem, and, you know, women need to kind of raise their consciousness and get their priorities in order. And you know, she's so patronizing about it. You know, she speculates about all the reasons why, you know, women are still kind of brainwashed into putting their own needs second. And that's why they are leftist instead of feminist or whatever. And but you could maybe speculate that she is protesting too much, right? Because, I mean, and I realize you don't get very far, like, sort of armchair psychoanalyzing, but, you know, the tenor of the analysis is so, I wonder if she would have been more comfortable in a way in a queer organizing setting. Because then she wouldn't have had the internal fight with you know, with her own gender nonconformity, perhaps speculating. So, but it sucks that she's the voice of family abolition in feminism, because actually, you know, there were so many lesbians and Black organizers, womanist or intersectional feminist socialists who are talking about mothering in this kind of dialectical utopian way, and talking about children as belonging to no one but themselves, you know, to quote the Sisterhood of Black Single Mothers, who are talking about revolutionizing welfare and the foster care system, you know, in terms that I would call family abolitionist, right? Who are talking about placing care, but not just any old care, you know, an emancipatory comradely care at the center of transformative politics. And, you know, if that was what we thought of as family abolition, rather than this kind of rude, muscular, kind of femphobic statement about how, you know, pregnancy is like shitting a pumpkin and we should just admit that pregnant people look wrong. And I realize I'm playing into this problem because I am kind of choosing this text to talk about, and like I'm singling it out, and that's because it has many other kind of marvelous features. But you know, on this specific point, I think family abolition would have been better served as in its legacy if it had been articulated by someone who was maybe you know, queerer, yeah, or part of the Black lesbian struggle of single mothers and other mothers, and coming from that kind of perspective of, you know, marginalized communities whose knowledge in the domain of you know, surthrivance and care and kin making against the family, you know, real family making, real families against the family, if you like, if you want to capitulate and use the word family in a sort of transitional sense, you know, that would have been, I think, that would have made my job in 2020 easier as someone repping family abolition, you know, because people would understand it as something about love and about comradeliness and proliferations, you know, of tenderness and provision and abundance, you know, and not simply a sort of, yeah, like a kind of top-down technological fix. Not what she says, but she you know, it isn't a mystery why she has been misunderstood in that way, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I really love this idea of unbounding love from, by like family commitments towards like a real sense of care and solidarity and comradeship once family institution is not like kind of policing this kind of these relations, the family unit, like, yes, in the way we're talking about right now. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's this personal anecdote I share towards the end of my book where I, you know, and it was a memory that only came to me or returned to me two-thirds of the way through writing Full Surrogacy Now, which was really, you know, a bit of a shock, a bit like finding yourself naked on stage in the middle of a show or something, you know. But I share it in the book. I say that, you know, I was in the car, this nuclear family context of the family car with my brother in the back seat with me and my mother in front and my dad driving. And I was sort of precociously talking about a play that we had just gone to see, En Famille. And I was like, oh, you know, but it doesn't make any sense, dad, daddy, if you suddenly found out that, you know, my brother, that Ben and I were technically the children of the milkman, you wouldn't suddenly love us any less, right? Right? Huh? And there's just this horrible silence. And I didn't get the answer that I obviously needed. And it's not that I wanted him to lie. I wanted him to give the answer I needed and for it not to be a lie. And I think I did understand at that moment, perhaps on some level, that the you know, of course there are people who are bio family to one another, who are biologically fathers and mothers or whatever to one another, and who do love each other in a comradely way, in a curious way that actually kind of presupposes that everyone needs to be adopted. You know, a baby can come out of your body and yet, you know, is a stranger and has nothing to do with you and is not simply a continuation of your identity, right? And that's where comradely parenting does occur. And if you experience that or even experienced it sometimes, great, good for you, you know, it's wonderful. But there is a logic. And I think in people like my father, it's quite, you know, integrated. That really the point of caring for someone else is because they are an extension of yourself. And that is such a violence to be on the receiving end of. And so I've always been interested, I suppose you could say, in you know, in that queer premise that, you know, that kinship is can be made into a real commitment, into a something approaching unconditionality, you know, but not on the basis that you have some biogenetic property that links you, but on the basis of a sort of a will, of a decision, of a comradeliness, of a series of actions and affinities out of love, you know? And it's not that it makes it superior. It's not superior to make kin with someone who has, you know, no biological link to you. It's just that queer people, by virtue of, you know, necessity, have become extremely skillful. It's not enough. It's still not enough, unfortunately. I don't want to romanticize, you know, queer community. It's not enough. It's not good enough. but it is something kind of asymptotically kind of gesturing towards the truly livable earth that I think many of us really hunger for.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
A beautiful place to.
So yeah, I think we can finish now, if that's fun. It was really nice to have you, and it was a great discussion.
Thank
you ever so much. Yeah, it's been great. I'll see you, you know, in gatherings and meetings throughout the pandemic, and maybe in person one day. I'll just say to whoever's watching that it's always great to hear from people, we'll put some ways of being in touch in the links below. All right,
kiss kiss,
bye.
Clap your hands now, give it away, the bass drop.